Wild Tales is sponsored by Cotswold Outdoor. When we're out in the elements, we're in our element. And outside retail expert Cotswold Outdoor is helping more of us to get out with the right kit. Thanks also to their support, the National Trust is helping walking communities to access the UK's outside spaces. And we're working to fix 15,000 kilometres of paths and trails by 2030 for everyone to enjoy. Find your element with Cotswold Outdoor.
The overview effect is something that astronauts have been reporting back from the very early days of human spaceflight, and it's described as a cognitive shift in perspective of seeing your home planet from space. I think at some level it's certainly spiritual for everybody.
Imagine floating 250 miles above the Earth. No gravity, no noise, and gazing down at a fragile, beautiful blue sphere hanging against the backdrop of infinite darkness. Now imagine returning to Earth and never seeing the world the same way again. I'm Ajay Tagala, ranger with the National Trust on Wicken Fen in Cambridgeshire. Welcome to Wild Tales, the Overview Effect. Today, let's explore space, perspective, and how seeing the Earth from a different point of view changes everything about the way we interact with the world and each other. We're examining something called the overview effect, a mind-bending shift experienced by astronauts when they see the Earth from space. We'll hear from astronaut Tim Peake, artist Luke Jerram, and reaction to Luke's recent artwork, Helios, which enables the general public to experience some of the awe and wonder of our solar system without needing to fly in a rocket. The first step on the mission to understand the overview effect leads us to Dufferin Gardens near Cardiff. It's a 55-acre Edwardian estate featuring beautiful gardens, an arboretum, and was originally designed and built in the 1890s.
My name is Luke Jerram, and I'm the artist behind this sun artwork, Helios, which is here in Cardiff. This is a 7-metre sculpture of the sun, and it's composed of 400,000 photographs of the surface of the sun. So it allows the public to see all the details, all the sunspots, filaments, spicules, in perfect detail. And it's suspended from a truss over the gardens, and then in the background we've got the beautiful house for everyone to see as well. So yeah, it looks really nice. And in fact, further down the garden there's this beautiful long, almost like a long pond I suppose, that creates beautiful reflections of this sun artwork in that pond.
A crew are busily checking every aspect of the artwork.
We've suspended artworks like this from trees over lakes. We've suspended them from buildings, cranes, all around the world. From Hong Kong to Dubai, from Sydney to Los Angeles. I have a lot of experience of presenting it in different contexts.
Are there any common reactions from the audiences around the world?
There's a sense of awe and wonder when people experience these artworks. And this artwork of the sun is internally illuminated, so in the evening it should be very beautiful. And it's got this rippling light that sort of animates the surface of the sun as well.
So, what originally started Luke's journey to becoming an artist when he was a child?
I was really interested in drawing and making things. I was the sort of kid who would take stuff apart. So I'd be taking radios or TVs apart to see what was going on inside. And then, of course, you tried to put them back together and they'd never quite go back together and work properly ever again. But I think, yeah, artists and scientists and engineers have got that curiosity. And in fact, I had a place at university to do engineering, but decided to do an art degree instead. But actually that interest in thinking about the practicalities and forces and structures and materials and inventing things, you know, I'm still using all those ideas from engineering in my artwork.
But learning the language of science was only the first step towards creating artwork that has been acclaimed and displayed worldwide. What other steps were key to Luke's journey in creating Helios?
I'm from Bristol. Bristol's got the second highest tidal range in the world there. So about 20 years ago, I remember cycling over the river and noticing someone had stolen all the water. And of course, it's the moon that makes that happen. And that gave me an idea to make an artwork controlled by the moon. And that was a project called Tide, and it took about 2 years. I made this installation controlled by the moon. But back then, I also had this idea to make a replica moon that would be sort of emerging out of the sea. But back then, the data wasn't available from NASA. They hadn't sent up the satellites, and printing technology hadn't been invented. So I literally had to sort of sit on the idea for 10 years, wow, waiting for the opportunity to then make a beautiful moon sculpture. That was the first project we made. In fact, the first moon we made was helium-filled, and it popped. There's a film of me on CBBC of like this thing popping outdoors in very high winds. It's a film of me with my mouth open. There's all this helium, 3.5 grams worth of helium just going up like this. But anyway, you know, that's the nature of doing new things sometimes, is you have to be willing to step into the unknown. You've got to be able to recover and learn from mistakes and where things go wrong. So anyway, the moon was very successful. I toured it all around the world. Maybe 300 presentations of the moon. And we created an Earth, and then we've created the Mars. And then the opportunity came up to make the sun. And I thought, actually, there's that universal appeal, isn't there, with the sun? It has significance in every culture and religion, inspired music and poetry. And the sun is a sort of life source for all life on our planet. So that's one of the reasons I made this sun.
Creating artwork that connects people from different countries and young and old is a huge challenge.
I try to make artworks that have multiple doors of entry. So yeah, a four-year-old child will enjoy running around on the grass and hiding in the shadows, and they'll have a very memorable time. But scientists get very excited, and astronomers get very excited by seeing these sculptures of the moon or the Earth or the sun, as we've got here up close, and seeing all the details for the first time. But I suppose the thing about the sun is we're not ordinarily allowed to look at it, you know, so we're not used to looking at the surface of the sun. So it's quite unusual to have an artwork that provides that opportunity.
It wasn't that long ago that some people saw art and science as opposing disciplines. What helped Luke view them as complementary?
I think both artists and scientists are interested in phenomena. I'm interested in interrogating the world. What's a rainbow made of? How does that work? You know, what's the surface of the sun actually look like? And that interest is, yeah, universal for both engineers and scientists and artists. With art, I suppose, I've realised that I can create an artwork that can reach very large audiences. And actually, that seems to be quite valuable for scientists to be able to communicate their research. So I'm often collaborating with scientists, and my job is to communicate some difficult scientific ideas, and I can do that through art and bring in new audiences for them as well.
So, what does it really feel like to see Earth from space? Well, to truly understand the overview effect, you need to speak to someone who's actually lived it.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Tim Peake was the first British astronaut aboard the International Space Station. He spent 6 months orbiting the Earth at 17,500 miles per hour, circling the planet more than 2,500 times. We catch up with him to find out about the life-changing experience on a walk at the National Trust's Petworth Park near the South Downs.
As a young boy, I had that fascination of kind of looking up to the stars in awe and wonder, and had a Lego set, I remember, with a big rocket on the back, and I loved building that. And so I guess there was always a spark of space right from the beginning.
Tim's career path didn't lead directly to becoming an astronaut. He joined the Army Air Corps and eventually became a helicopter pilot. Over 18 years, he served in and tested many different types of helicopters around the world, including the iconic Apache in the USA. As his experiences grew, he faced a tricky choice, whether or not to stay in the army and be promoted out of flying, or choose a riskier path that enabled him to stay in the cockpit as a test pilot. He chose the latter, and it was this choice that meant he was ready for the opportunity of a lifetime.
And that led me to being right place, right time, right qualifications when ESA had their selection process.
ESA, or the European Space Agency, was recruiting for astronauts. And Tim applied and was given a chance, along with over 8,000 high-caliber applicants from all over Europe. He took part in the year of tests, gradually getting down to the last group.
On the internet, the European Space Agency said, we're going to announce the new astronauts on Wednesday. On the Monday night beforehand, the phone rang and it was a number from Paris. And I thought, well, this is the rejection call, because whoever has been selected, they would have been told at least a week in advance. They would have probably already been out to Paris. They would be prepped. They would have had some PR training, all the rest of it. This is Monday night. Can't possibly be me. So I was fully expecting to have a pleasant conversation, to be told, I'm sorry you didn't make it. And the conversation went the other way. That said, can you be in Paris on Wednesday? Yeah, we'd like you to join the European Astronaut Corps.
Despite the huge upheaval it had been for his family, Tim felt it was an opportunity he couldn't miss.
We didn't know where we would be living, what life would be like, but it was one of those things. You just have to grasp the opportunity with both hands, and how could you possibly say no to being an astronaut?
Tim moved his family to Cologne in Germany and began the extensive training required to blast off into space.
There's a huge amount of training to become an astronaut for a mission to the International Space Station.
Tim's life became a whirlwind of Russian language lessons, survival training in Siberian forests, underwater spacewalk simulations, and even deep cave exploration in Sardinia to test how he operated in extreme isolated environments.
If you want to be a space station astronaut, you need to be able to fly the spacecraft, dock the spacecraft, do all the cargo operations, do all the maintenance, use the robotic arm, conduct a spacewalk, be the doctor, be the dentist, be the electrician, be the plumber, be the IT guy who strips down the computer. And we haven't even spoken about the science yet. So, so you're talking about 2.5 years of basic training, which all space station crew members do. And that's great, because it means that whether you're from Japan or from Russia or from Canada or from Europe, you're all doing that same basic training package.
And finally, after years of preparation and sacrifice, the moment arrives. Sitting on top of a rocket, waiting to blast off to space on a mission to the ISS.
Sitting on top of the rocket is quite an interesting time, because you've had so much happen before in your career as an astronaut to date. In terms of whoever becomes an astronaut, you have given up a previous career at which you were very good. If you weren't very good at it, you wouldn't have been chosen to be an astronaut. So everybody has sacrificed a very good career doing something they loved and something they were passionate about. And you've gambled all of that on, will I get a mission to space? You've gone through many, many years of training, which has had huge family upheaval, probably seeing your family less than 50% of the time for all of those years. And you've kind of had this whirlwind of preparation in getting you to the point where you're going to sit on top of a rocket. And then finally, you're on top of the rocket. And it's the culmination of all of that. And the hatch closes and you have this kind of change of mindset, really, where you're just focused on the mission ahead. And the only thing you're nervous about is not going. People think you're not scared taking a trip on a rocket to space. It's like, no, I'm nervous about the launch being scrubbed and for some reason not getting to space.
3, 2, 1.
Tim bursts a misconception about the moments before takeoff.
We don't actually have a countdown. That's one of the most surprising things, I think, for people, is outside they have a countdown. If you're watching the launch, you've got a nice board there which has got your countdown ticking away for the press and for the family and friends watching the launch. But inside the spacecraft, what we're doing is we're going through the checklist and then we're also watching the systems come online. So for us, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, that's not important at all. What's important for us are things like the fuel systems pressurized, the turbo pumps are up and running, the engines are at 50%, the engines are at 75%, the engines are at 100%, 2 second hold, and now we go. It's very hard to feel that moment because there's so much vibration, there's so much noise. that you don't actually feel the rocket lifting off the launch pad. It's only after probably about 3 or 4 seconds that the G-force starts to kick in as the rocket builds speed, and then you start getting pressed into your seat. You realise, yeah, we're definitely on our way now.
Tim described the experience of being inside a rocket like being inside a giant power tool.
In terms of the G-force, it kind of builds gradually but rapidly up to about 4 Gs, and then the first stage boosters get jettisoned, and then the G-force completely washes off at that point as the second stage picks up. So for a moment there, you feel almost a little bit weightless in the rocket as those first stage boosters fall away. It feels like you're kind of pitching forward. If you didn't know better, you might think, oh, we're falling back to Earth again. It's quite disconcerting. But then the second stage picks up, and it's a much gentler ride on the second stage, so about 2 Gs. And then the second stage drops off, and the third stage picks up, and the third stage, by now you're up in space, and the rocket is horizontal, it's not vertical anymore. It's pretty much got most the altitude it needs. It now needs speed. So the third stage is absolute acceleration. It's mind-blowing. It's back up to 4 Gs. That's getting you from probably about 10 times the speed of sound up to 25 times the speed of sound. So that's 17,500 miles an hour. You can't really comprehend what that's like.
The journey from Earth to space only takes 9 minutes. And as you can hear, it is hard to put into words the feeling of leaving the planet on which you have thus far spent your whole life and getting to space.
It's an absolutely crazy 9 minutes. There's a huge amount of fun as well, a huge adrenaline rush. And at the same time, you've got this childish excitement of what's going on, mixed with the professional astronaut who's kind of keeping an eye on the rocket on the way up. But when the main engine's cut out, everything goes really quiet and everything floats up into the cockpit. So instantly you can let go of your checklist, and it's floating in front of you for the first time. You're kind of experiencing proper weightlessness in orbit. And then you can unstrap, you can take your gloves off, you can lift up the visor on your spacesuit, you can look out of the window and have a glance down at Earth for the first time.
Tim describes the moment he first saw the Earth from space.
Well, the first moment I saw the Earth was from the Soyuz. First time I kind of floated up out the seat, and we were going into the night because it had been a late evening launch in December. So we were going over the Sea of Japan, and darkness was all in front. We were just about to coast out over the Pacific, and the first thing I saw was this beautiful moonrise over the water. And that was just stunning, to see that from space. And then all the stars came out with no light pollution, and you're kind of looking up at the Milky Way. And it was a nice way of seeing Earth, because it actually gave me more appreciation for when I saw Earth in the daytime. We had this stunning sunrise, and then you see the beautiful blue marble of our planet. So I really loved the fact that it was revealed to me more slowly, rather than just kind of into space and bang, there it is, full daylight.
So, as Tim began to take in this beautiful scene, what details drew his eye?
The way that Earth reveals itself is incredible, because it's geology that stands out, and the weather systems. We talk about it being a blue marble, and of course 2/3 of the planet is covered in ocean, so you would expect to see those beautiful blues of the ocean and the white clouds. But when you're looking at the continents, it's the rock strata that stands out, or it's the colour that stands out. So the Sahara Desert, for example, is the beautiful orange colour that you get. It's like looking at a Martian landscape. Sand dunes that are hundreds of metres tall, making these incredible patterns, the bright orange ripple effect. Or down in Eritrea and Ethiopia, and you get this amazing rock strata. Or the rainforests, where you get the lush green coming out. Or when we launched, it was winter, so the continent of North America was just covered in snow and ice. So it's big picture stuff. And then once you've been wowed by the big picture stuff, your eye starts to kind of hone in and pick out the details. And that might be volcanoes that you'll see. It might be big ice shelves that are carving off from Antarctica and then kind of floating up, and kind of enjoy then, as time goes on, picking out those smaller details, almost like precious moments just for yourself, where you might be the first person to notice a volcano erupting in Kamchatka.
Observing from space, the way Tim thought about the world began to change.
You just see the continents. There are no borders from space. You don't see any lines on the map. So if you see something amazing, like, oh, look at that asteroid impact crater, get a photograph of it. And now I want to know, where is it? And I've got no idea. You know, I might know that it's in North Africa, but there are no lines on the map exactly. So I couldn't tell exactly which country in North Africa it was in. And that's true for the whole globe. So you're seeing things on a planetary scale, and you're looking at the amazing geology of Earth rather than actually the individual countries of Earth.
And so, focusing on the overview effect, what did this experience of seeing Earth add up to for Tim?
The overview effect is something that astronauts have been reporting back from the very early days of human spaceflight. And I think it's described as a cognitive shift in perspective of seeing your home planet from space. And it's different for different people. I mean, I think at some level it's certainly spiritual for everybody to see it. And what strikes me really about seeing Earth from space is the isolation, I think. It is very remote, very isolated. It's this tiny rocky jewel of a planet, and it's very special when you see it from space. There's no doubting that there is a vibrant, lively planet down there. Against the vast black drop of space, you kind of think, wow, you know, that's it, that's home.
Returning to Earth sounds more of a scary experience than taking off in some ways, as the physics are reversed and the rocket descends at terrifying speeds of thousands of miles an hour. Tim arrived back safely, and his life continued at a fast pace as he continued to work in the space industry and used his profile to fundraise for charities, communicating with young and old how important it is to treasure and look after the world we live in. Back at Luke Jerram's artwork, The Helios, what does Tim feel the role of art can play in helping the public experience something akin to the overview effect? And how will that then change the way that we look after our planet?
I think that kind of work is incredibly important with artists who are trying to help people to visualise what space is like, what our solar system is like, our sun and our home planet. When we go into space, we're so lucky we see that with our own eyes, and there's no hiding from it. There's no hiding from the level of isolation and remoteness that you feel, not just as an individual in space, but you feel that for the whole planet. You think, oh God, that's it, that tiny little rock. And the sun is magnificent. The moon is beautiful. But here on Earth, it's very easy to not appreciate that. We've got a lovely blue sky above us today, and you don't really think about the fact that that's just not nice and comforting and blue up there. That's really scary black, and it goes on for infinity. And 16 kilometres up there, you know, you're going to be in an incredibly hostile environment. And the sun is not this warm yellow glow that we all draw as kids. The sun is this bright white nuclear fusion reaction. It's this amazing star that's powering the whole solar system. And I think art plays a really valuable part in helping people to visualise that and helping people to appreciate the realities of what it's like out in space.
So with that in mind, returning to Luke Jerram's artwork, how did members of the public respond to seeing Helios?
I'm Carrie. My first response was just awe. I spent quite a long time just sort of sitting under it, around it, seeing the different perspectives, seeing the detail of it. It's more than maybe you'd expect. You just think, oh, big sun, that'll be really cool. And then actually it kind of draws you in and you just kind of want to hang out around it, really.
I'm Earl Smith. Yeah, it certainly is significant. The colours and just the shape of it all is truly amazing.
I'm Sue Frost. Quite impressive, I think, isn't it? But I never knew that hotspots were specifically in those spaces. I thought they might kind of move all over the place.
I find it quite immersive and quite mesmerising, if I'm honest.
It is that awe-inspiring, oh wow, that's what keeps us alive, that's what brings life. And I think it is that sheer scale and the awesomeness of our solar system and of our Earth. It brings a bit of hope as well, actually. We are like stewards of this planet, we have a lot to care for.
And now, a final reflection from Tim.
It makes you appreciate that we are all sharing the atmosphere, because you see, with every one of those sunrises and sunsets, you see how thin the atmosphere is. 16 kilometres, that's nothing. And when the sunlight goes through it, it's this tiny, tiny strip of gas. you kind of think, wow, you know, how lucky are we that Earth has trapped that layer of gas, and that layer of gas is just the right composition at the moment to sustain all life as we know it. And so as far as we know, you know, we're the only planet in the solar system where there is life. Could be on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn where there are liquid oceans, who knows? But it makes you appreciate what we have down here. And you also see how interconnected everything is. You see the vast weather systems. You can see them building in the Atlantic in hurricane season. You can see the dust storms in the Sahara and the impact it has. We had the wildfires in Alberta when I was on board in 2016, spread across the whole continent of North America. And you see the smoke just trapped in our tiny atmosphere spreading. And it makes you realize that everything's connected, and that thin atmosphere, there's only so much that you can put into it before it starts to affect everybody on the planet.
Tim Peake's time in space lasted 186 days, but its impact has reached far beyond the confines of the International Space Station and inspired people from all around the world. Perhaps that's one of the lasting legacies of his space travel. Not just the scientific or technological achievements, but the valuable perspective it offers each one of us. Thanks for listening to this episode of Wild Tales. If you liked it, why not give us a like or a follow? We will be back soon with another episode in a couple of weeks. But if you can't wait that long, why not check out our other nature podcast, Nature Fix? Or if you like your history too, there's Back When. I'll see you next time.
Wild Tales is sponsored by Cotswold Outdoor, your outside retailer and epic guides to adventure. Quick breathers, calming walks, or heart-pounding hikes. We feel better when we get out more. Find quality kit and 50 years of outdoor wisdom. Plus, National Trust supporters get 15% off walking kit in-store and online. Feel in your element, in the elements, at cotswoldoutdoor.com.